Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher.
I'm addicted to my children, sir. I love them with all my heart. And the idea of someone telling me I can't be with them, I can't see them every day, it's like someone saying I can't have air. I can't live without air, and I can't live without them.
In that scene from the 1993 film Mrs. Doubtfire, the title character, played by actor Robin Williams, exemplifies the anguish of one newly divorced father vying for the custody of his children. In that story, the Williams character went to great lengths to be with his children, but even when that's not the problem, co-parenting often is. And when you don't even like your ex anymore, it's a bigger problem. Joining us now by phone from Reston, Virginia, is psychologist Dr. Edward Farber. He is founder of Reston Psychological Center and Reston Family Center, and he's the author of a new book, Raising the Kid You Love with the Ex You Hate. Dr. Farber, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Ann. Thank you for having me, and thanks for being back in the air in Columbus. I've been missing Columbus for many, many years.
By the way, Dr. Farber will be in Columbus for the 50th annual Columbus Jewish Book Fair. If for more information about that, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. So, Dr. Farber, you start the book with a description of an amazingly functional couple post-divorce and how they work to maintain a relationship between the father and the son who live far apart. I almost thought it sounded fictional. For one thing, are they real? And what were your thoughts about starting with something so positive?
Oh, it's absolutely real, and it's to the extent that the young man that I speak about always wishes that I could use his name. But what it demands is a working arrangement between two parents who are able to put their anger and their rancor aside to be able to do what's really best for their child post-separation and divorce. It would be so easy in this situation to go downhill, but it's a case where a father's living across the country and really struggles to maintain a relationship with his son post-separation and divorce, and it involves the mother's agreement that this is going to have to work hard to make this arrangement effective, and they struggle and they work to allow this child to maintain an ongoing, real, and consistent relationship with both of his parents. And for me, it really is an uplifting sense. It's a sense that after you finish with the battle of the war of divorce, you really can still both focus on being parents for your child.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Edward Farber. He's written a new book. It's called Raising the Kid You Love with the Ex You Hate. If you have a good story to tell, give us a call, 614-292-8513. We'd like to hear post-courtroom stories about success, how you've managed to make this work with your children after divorcing. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So let's talk about that title, Raising the Kid You Love with the Ex You Hate. Is the divorce vitriol necessarily the problem, or is it the challenging logistics of co-parenting that drive people insane and cause a lot of the problems with the kids?
It's really both, Anne. You've grown apart from your spouse. You struggle, the dreams, the aspirations you've had for so many years, that white picket fence, going to your child's high school graduation, all of those dreams are now shattered as you go through this process of divorce. And the process itself is such a difficult one. We're dealing not just with basic values of who you are as a person. We're dealing with financial successes and failures for your future. And we're dealing with your identity as a parent that you've maintained and developed for so many years. Everything changes. And because of those changes, it's so easy for this process to become filled with anger and filled with frustration and ultimately filled with loss. And it really becomes a question then of how you as an individual, with still the parent of your child, are able to rebuild a relationship that allows you to have this functional, business-like relationship post-separation to focus your attention on the business of raising a successful child. And it's not easy to do. The process ensures that it's not so easy to do that.
We're not going to talk about the courtroom and the negotiations and that sort of thing. But in your opinion, a lot of the cases that you see are referred from a courtroom to you. Do the courts help or do they hurt? Are they getting any better at this?
Well, each court is a little different. Each county has a different system. And my perspective, and I've been across the country and visiting a number of different court systems, my perspective is the courts are getting much better. And the courts are much more sensitive to the needs of the child. Look, there used to be a pretty traditional model.
Right.
If you got divorced, mom got the kids, dad would visit the kids on some alternate weekends, and sometimes dad paid the bills. Well, we know that model doesn't work anymore. And probably the most common model now is a co-parenting model. Co-parenting demands that both parents are involved in both the decision-making and the day-to-day care of the child to some degree after the separation and after the divorce. And this co-parenting model has lots of frustrations that are built in with it. The courts are sensitive to that, and the courts don't really, however, have the mechanism post-separation and divorce to be able to help people through this process. The courts are very effective in helping you get divorced. Courts are very effective in making financial decisions. Courts are effective in making determination of where your child might live. Although I need to tell you that 85% of the divorce cases, folks are able to work that out themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So it's really just the court needing to make those decisions in roughly about 15% of the situations.
Ultimately, the courts can do the best job humanly possible, but if the two people or the three or the however many people at the center of the family aren't willing to make it easier, it doesn't matter.
If you and your ex can't decide whether your daughter is going to be playing softball on Saturdays or soccer on Saturdays, and you're still at war with each other 3 years after you're divorced, yes, the courts are pretty helpless at being able to assist you in your co-parenting process. Of course, you can go back to court and back to court and back to court and ask a judge to help you raise your child and make that decision for you. Or you can learn a new process of dealing with each other that's very different from the process that probably failed in your marriage, and learn how to make those decisions effectively for your child with your ex in a fashion that removes a lot of the hostility and a lot of the anger from the relationship with your ex.
Just want to remind listeners, we're not talking about the courts. We're talking about after the courts and how you work with your ex to build relationships with your children post-divorce. Dr. Farber, you wrote that when you first started to see children of divorce, you expected their problems to be mild compared to seriously traumatized patients, like patients who had been sexually molested or badly neglected or abused. And that wasn't necessarily the case.
Well, I worked for a number of years at what had been Children's Hospital in Columbus, and now Nationwide Children's Hospital. I was at OSU. And working at the hospital, I would see children in the burn unit, and I would see people in diabetic care, and I saw children who had substantial losses and hurts in their lives. And when I began to work more extensively with children where there were losses from separation and divorce, I could not believe for a moment that the hurt and the pain to the child from a divorce would be anywhere near the hurt and the pain for a child who had this other significant physical trauma in their life. But I found the reactions in the children to be very much the same. There's a loss of functioning. There's a drop in academic performance. There's a loss of social functioning. Now, someone just told me a study of, and I haven't seen it yet, of children after divorce. Their Little League baseball average goes down the year or two after the divorce. And that's minor, of course, but the impact of the separation and divorce on children is substantial and powerful and significant, and we need to be sensitive to that.
You referred to the developmental need of a child to be emotionally connected to both parents. What impact on the development of a child does a disconnect have?
It's pretty powerful if a child is not effectively connected to both parents. And it shows itself in two time periods, one short term and one perhaps many, many years later. So the short term effect is a drop in functioning. We see a drop in grade point average. We see more acting out behaviors if a child doesn't have a meaningful relationship with both parents. We see a change in just day-to-day functioning and behaviors around the house. You get the sullen, angry child or the withdrawn child much more if you don't have a meaningful relationship with both parents. And that's the short-term effect. The long-term effect is much more powerful and significant, and we see in some follow-up studies 15 years later, after the divorce, the children who haven't had a meaningful relationship with both parents after divorce, and where that relationship has a lot of anger to it, it doesn't work. But the ones who are able to have a meaningful relationship post-divorce without a lot of anger have healthy young 20-year-old kinds of impacts. But the ones who haven't had a parent or for whom there's been a great deal of anger, we see a real deterioration in performance. They can't form good adult relationships. They have difficulty getting and maintaining their first jobs, higher criminal and drug and alcohol use and abuse. So it's much more of a disaster 15 years later if you don't have this healthy relationship with both parents after a divorce.
When I was reading the different stories, case studies in your book, I was struck that a lot of times maybe one parent is keeping a child from another parent or making it difficult. That child doesn't necessarily have a better relationship with the parent that they're living with than they do with the one that they're keeping them from. It's weird.
The parent who is either enmeshed with the child, mm-hmm. meaning I'm so involved, I have to be so careful, my daughter can't possibly go over to her father's house because he doesn't really feed her well, and so she's going to, you know, not have a good appetite and a diet when she returns home. Or the parent who really is keeping the child from the other parent for all sorts of reasons, maybe his or her own psychological needs. I need to be close to this child. I need a friend. Or maybe because they really truly believe that the other parent is going to damage that child in a more meaningful way. In fact, don't really help that child at all. You have perhaps the right intention. Perhaps you're trying to protect your child. But face it, is your child really going to get hurt if they eat at McDonald's on Saturday afternoon every other week, as compared to the healthy diet that you feed it, your child? It's far more important for your child to have a meaningful relationship with that parent. If dad never learned how to cook while you were married, why should dad sort of learn how to cook when you're divorced? So he's going to do eating out, and he's going to be eating at fast foods places. And it's far more important for that child to have a relationship than for the parents to have a battle about whether or not that father can cook for that child. And I'm throwing gender out here. It could easily be mother. It could easily mm-hmm. be father. It could easily be significant other.
Once again, my guest is Dr. Edward Farber. He's a psychologist and author of Raising the Kid You Love with the Ex You Hate. He'll be in town soon for the 50th annual Columbus Jewish Book Fair. For more information, go to the link on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In this scene from the film Kramer vs. Kramer, characters played by Dustin Hoffman and Meryl Streep meet to discuss custody.
I want my son.
You can't have him.
Now don't get defensive. Don't try to bully me.
I'm not getting defensive. Who walked out of the house 15 months ago?
I don't care.
Joe.
I am still his mother.
Yes, from 3,000 miles away, and just because you sent a few postcards, it gives you the right to come back
him.
Here?
I never stopped wanting him.
What makes you so sure he wants you?
What makes you so sure he doesn't want me?
There is a lot of resentment in that scene, similar to what I'm sure many real parents face. How can parents move on from what's occurred in the past and focus on the future of their situation? Joining us today to talk about that is Dr. Edward Farber, a psychologist and author of a new book. It's called Raising the Kid You Love with the Ex You Hate. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Please, no courtroom stories. This is post-courtroom. We're talking about, and preferably positive stories. Let's get to Don from Columbus right now. You've been waiting. Hi, Don. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having Dr. Farber on. This is, sounds like a great book. I was divorced in the early 90s, and I had one of these sort of middle-of-the-road divorces. It was not one of the friendly, wonderful stories. It was not one of the most acrimonious either. But I was one of the very fortunate ones who was able to get shared parenting of my children. I had my children with me 40% of the time right from the beginning, and by the end 50% of the time, and that was over the objections of my ex. And one of the points I wanted to make, I know you don't want to delve into the courtroom issues, mm-hmm. but the courts exacerbate problems because they see families at their absolute worst time, and then they generalize from that. And so what I wanted to say is that even when, you know, my ex did not believe that shared parenting would work because she thought that we didn't agree on things. And we're now 20 years out. I'm a grandfather of a one-year-old. I'm going out this weekend to my son's wedding in California. And the kids have done very well, even though we didn't agree on everything, even though we might have had different bedtimes for the kids and so forth. So what I would want to stress is that courts should not assume that shared parenting doesn't work because when the couples come before the court, the couples are locked into acrimonious relationships with one another. Some of that is really an artifact of the adversarial legal system that we have decided to use for divorce.
Well, we were talking about that earlier, and Don, thanks a lot for your call. Dr. Farber, you think things are getting better, though?
Don, thank you for your message, and it's good to know that you can, you know, go to that one-year-old's party together, I hope. We know that in most situations, 1.5 years to 2 years after parental separation and divorce, a lot of the anger that you feel during this process begins to fade. People do move on with their lives. Things that were critically important during the war battles of the divorce and for the year or so after that seem to ease in intensity. It just doesn't matter anymore whether bedtime is 8:30 in one house and 9 o'clock in the other house a year or two later. What really matters is that your child is healthy, your child is developing well, and the conflicts between you and your ex that were so critical before are now so diminished in intensity, and people move on with their lives. So part of it is just developmental. Part of it is just really getting through a process that is adversarial and being able to protect what's the most important for you over time, your child. So, Don, I'm glad you're able to do that.
Thanks again, Don, and congratulations on the wedding in California next week. Dr. Farber, you make the point that if parents continue to fight after the divorce is settled, that naturally the kid is going to think it's his or her fault because what's left?
Well, it's interesting is that if we look at the long-term follow-up effects, and I'm putting my academic scientist hat on right now, of separation and divorce, that the level of conflict pre-divorce doesn't really seem to affect as much how the kids do 10 and 15 years later. It's as if kids are able to say, look, I know mom and dad fought with each other all the time. Duh. That's why they got a divorce. Makes sense, right? But later, when mom and dad are separated and divorced, and they're still at war with each other, and every time there's a transition from mom's house to dad's house or dad's house to mom's house, they're yelling and screaming about the support payments or about who was late by 7 minutes in the exchange last week. Well, there's only one thing they're fighting about, and that's me. So it really has to be my fault. Before Anne, we talked a little bit about the 15-year follow-up studies and how important it is to have both parents involved in the life of the child. Mm-hmm. That's the first factor of importance. The second factor of importance is that you co-parent after separation and divorce without a lot of conflict, without a lot of fighting, that the fights that you had before end, and now you move on to a different kind of relationship where you and your ex both have to raise this product, your child, to the most effective fashion you can. And you have to do that without conflict.
It may start with what you have to say, Rob. And Blacklick, you're on the air. Welcome, Rob.
Well, thank you for taking the call. And this seems to segue pretty neatly into, I guess, what my comment was. And that is on the entire concept of forgiveness, the ability to, you know, cooperatively function as a set of parents, even though you are in differing locations and perhaps of differing opinions, when one forgives, or I actually think that forgiveness is more a process than a discrete point in time, but when one decides to forgive the other, the person who is forgiving frees themselves from the need to carry forward in an adversarial role and can dispense with all the vitriol and bile, and it makes things much, much easier to to negotiate on a daily basis.
Sounds good, Dr. Farber.
Rob, I certainly agree with you. Let's remember that you once loved this person who's now your ex. You married, you pledged to be together till the end of time. You stayed up at night when your children were born. You worried when the first bad cough and cold came through with that infant. You looked at each other and, in fact, loved each other a great deal to stay together. Things changed over time. Things can change again. Whether it's forgiveness, acceptance, an ability to both have a common goal, which is that child of yours, we don't stay static. And the anger and frustrations of the divorce shouldn't stay static and shouldn't be the predominant form of your existence in the future. Allow yourself to move on. Allow yourself to move on in a relationship with your ex. You're still both going to be parents. You're still both going to be involved in the life of that child. It doesn't have to be a life filled with anger and rage. It also could be a life that allows, in Rob's terms, forgiveness, acceptance, and an ability to developmentally move on to another stage of your own life as well.
Rob, thanks a lot for that call. We appreciate it. You wrote about directed co-parenting counseling. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Certainly.
What you mean by that?
And this really grows out of various court systems throughout the United States with the frustrations of the court themselves at the animus that the court sees and the frustrations. So you have a divorce situation and you have a three-day battle in court where you're throwing every piece of mud you possibly can against your ex. And the decision at the end is some form of co-parenting, some process in which both of you are still involved from a legal perspective, jointly making decisions about your child, and from a physical custody perspective, sharing, maybe equally, maybe unequally, but still sharing in the physical rearing of your child. So you've just had a three-day battle. You've brought out every piece of ugly dirt you can in an attempt to win. And now you have to have a meeting with your child's guidance counselor in school to talk about whether your child needs a tutor, or a meeting in your pediatrician's office to talk about whether your child's putting on too much weight, or a meeting with the orthodontist and decide, do we really need the braces now or not? And you have to do this as co-parents. Well, how do you go about doing that? How do you change this process from one of animosity and hostility to one of effective co-parenting? And sometimes people get stuck. And to help that process along, the courts saw in various states a need for someone who's more involved and aware of the developmental needs of the child ongoing to assist the family in making those decisions happen. In most jurisdictions, there's what's called a Friday Motions Day. And I know, Andy, you didn't want to talk much about court, so
I'm
back
here a little bit. Day is kind of...
And what that tends to be is the situation that we talked about briefly before. One parent wants soccer, one parent wants softball, they're in different neighborhoods. Which, we're going to have the child play soccer every other Saturday and softball every other Saturday? That hurts the child, not helps the child. But these parents can't make a decision. So there are two choices. One, they walk into court on this Friday Motions Day, where each has 7.5 minutes of a 15-minute hearing put aside. That's what it is here in Washington, D.C. area. You have 15 minutes to present a specific issue to the judge, and the judge is going to resolve that issue. So now the judge is sitting on the bench, and she looks at the 17 file boxes from the 100 other motions that this family has filed, and she's got 15 minutes to decide whether your daughter is going to play soccer or going to play softball. And she knows the issue is much greater than that, but by law, she has to make a determination on that one issue, putting aside the 15 file boxes that are sitting there. There had to be a better way. So what was developed was this process called parent coordination. And parent coordinators are generally psychologists or social workers or lawyers who are trained in child development issues, who work with the family after separation and divorce to really assist in three kinds of things. One, helping implement the existing order. Two, helping the parents learn a different technique of communicating with each other post-separation and divorce so they can resolve issues. And three, giving recommendations or directives to the family should the family not be able to agree based on the need of the child. So you basically go to this parent coordinator and you sit with this person who now knows you and your family. And if there's a conflict between resolving soccer or softball, that parent coordinator helps teach you how you as parents can work together to come up with a decision. And if you fail to do that, can help you direct you what decision makes sense best for your child then.
An email from Hal. He writes, I have known many issues in which one parent feels that the children are not safe in how they spend time with the other parent. Can you speak to how important it is to ensure that the parents are satisfied with safety issues?
Thank you, Hal, for the email. Children have to be safe, but everyone's definition of safe is very different. Is safe mean that my child can't play football because football's not safe? And if one parent feels that football's not safe and the other parent feels that football is going to help that child adapt socially to his friends in the community, how do you resolve that? I think we all have a certain standard of safety. We're not going to take a five-year-old and say, hey, you know, you could be out on night by yourself and you could be walking the streets by yourself. But parents will disagree about normal patterns of safety. And that's where they have to learn how to communicate with each other, use some business models of decision-making to be able to reach resolution so that they together can decide on the important issues involved in the life of their child. But, you know, when you're divorced, you only control the day-to-day functioning of what goes on in your household. You don't control the day-to-day functioning of what goes on with your child in the other household. You're giving up control some of the time, and you have to willingly give up that control, understanding that your ex also has the best interests of your child in mind. It may not be the same as your perception of what the best interests are, but it is the best interest.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Dr. Farber, you wrote that there's no credible evidence that any one living arrangement is better for the child than another. So how do you decide which direction to take? How do you know what's best for your child? How can you get help with that?
And thanks for picking that up, because, in fact, it's probably the most common question that any mental health professional who works in this field is asked on the witness stand or in working with families. Isn't 50-50 better than 60-40, better than every other weekend, better than switching over the summer and any other permutation that you could think of? And the answer is there is no credible evidence that shows that any one living arrangement works better for a child than any other living arrangement. In fact, if the parents can resolve issues so that the child has three things going on, one, a meaningful relationship with both parents after separation and divorce, two, that relationship is absent a tremendous amount of conflict in front of the child, and three, a relationship that allows the child to see that my parents are still my parents as significant parts of my life, I'll come back to that in a minute, then that child is going to grow and develop well after separation and divorce, regardless of the specifics of the living arrangement. The living arrangement what parents fight about the most, and it probably has one of the least effects on the child. In fact, the best kind of a living arrangement is a living arrangement that the parents can work out that maximizes the amount of time that a child can spend with each of his or her parents. And the idea is to allow a parent to effectively parent a child, not necessarily just to own that child. Look, I've had situations here where I've had a very powerful Washington lawyer fight and win a great deal of time in custody, and he then turned around and hired three nannies to work with his child so that the nannies would be rearing the child rather than allow his ex-wife, who had greater availability of time, to spend time with the child. Yeah, he won. Didn't help the child very much over time. So the goal is, how do we structure a situation that allows the child to spend a maximum amount of time with each of his or her parents. That's the goal, not winning.
Yeah, in the story at the beginning of the book that we talked about, the positive story, you note that when the kid would be going over his homework with his dad, they would do it by phone because the dad lived on the other side of the country. And sometimes they would be arguing and the kid would be yelling at his dad like kids are wont to do. And you said that that proved the relationship was real. And it was kind of an interesting thing to think about. People say, well, he argues with her all the time or vice versa, and that must not be good. It's funny how that changes when you're divorced. When you're married, it's like, you know your kids argue with you.
Oh, it's great because, you know, if I sit down when I'm married and I'm doing homework with my child and the ex hears the arguments of the other room, then I'm really doing my job right. I'm getting him to sit down and do his science homework. And we all know that he doesn't want to do it. But if I'm divorced and my ex now hears that we're arguing about homework, well, I may be mean, I may be abusive, I may be a person who's out of control because, look, I'm arguing with a child. We have to not lose sight of the fact that there's normal processes of this development. There are normal things that occur in life. Not every relationship and not every contact with the other parent is going to be perfect. It wasn't perfect when you were married, and it's not going to be perfect when you're divorced. But it's just got to be real. And that's what's critical for the child. The story that I tell, of course, is that the father has to move to California, wants to keep up a relationship with the child, and father takes the responsibility for being the homework dad. So every day on the East Coast, it is 7 o'clock in the evening, and the child sits down to do homework. Dad in California in his office, it's 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and he is available for that 1 hour from 7 to 8 on the East Coast and 4 to 5 on the West Coast, and he's the homework person at that point. And the relationship of the child really evolves beautifully with that parent through the homework process. Now, I need to tell you that mom played a critical role in this.
Mm-hmm.
Because when the son goes in and complains to mom, oh, dad's so mean and he made me rewrite my book report, instead of mom saying, oh, right, he's mean, that's why we divorced, mom said, you know what, your dad is a great writer. And if he thinks it needs to be rewritten, I'm sure it does need to be rewritten. Dad's really a very good writer. Guess what? Go rewrite it like your dad told you to. It sounds so normal. It sounds so right for the child. It sounds so appropriate for these parents as well.
My guest is Dr. Edward Farber. He's the author of Raising the Kids You Love with the Ex You Hate. We'll return to our conversation after this. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Dr. Edward Farber, author of Raising the Kids You Love with the Ex You Hate. He will be in Columbus this week for the 50th annual Columbus Jewish Book Fair. For more information, go to the link on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Dr. Farber, does age have anything to do with any of this? In other words, if the children are 3 and 5, Is there a huge difference than, say, if they're 17 and 19?
How about if you're 30 and your parents decide they're getting a divorce?
Well, you know, they've made movies about that.
Yes, we have. Divorce is a breaking of trust to the child. And it doesn't matter very much if that child is 4 or 5 years old or that child is 17 or 18 years old. There's a trust that no matter what, my parents are always going to be there for me and protect me. It's that basic trust that lets the toddler take the first steps and lets the preschooler go to kindergarten and lets us take risks when we're 10 years old with our friends. We trust that no matter what, our family, our home, our support system is going to be there to help us get through this new and exciting process. Divorce shatters some of that trust, and then it takes some time for that trust to be rebuilt. So the answer to the question is, it's the same process. Whether you're 3 or 4 years old or you're 16 or 17 years old, it hurts and takes time to rebuild from that hurt.
And your relationship with the parent is the same sort of thing. It's as far as how the parent relates to the children about the ex.
It very much is. of course, there are different roles of different parents at different times in the life of the child.
Mm-hmm.
I just last week saw a father of a 13-year-old who sat in my office and said, "Oh, I don't understand her. I mean, what am I supposed to do to parent this 13-year-old girl?" And I looked at him and I smiled and I said, you know, join the list. There are a lot of parents who don't quite know how to parent a 13-year-old girl, but don't worry, at some point she'll be 16 or 17 and some element of sanity will return. Of course, I was being a bit facetious. But developmentally, yeah, there are different stages of life that are more difficult for children and parents to get along with each other than others. But we go through that if we're married, and we also go through that when we're divorced. Some of that process is the same.
I always love it when you hear from parents who say, oh, we finally got this under control or that under control, because they go, okay, great, well, something else is going to go wrong then.
Well, just wait.
Just wait. It's like the weather, right? Lisa in Cincinnati, you're on the air. You want to bring up the issue of friends and family and their impact on the process, and it's something that Dr. Farber does write about. Welcome to the show, Lisa.
Hi, thank you. I've been enjoying this show because I've been in a shared parenting situation for about 10 years now. It hasn't been perfect.
Few are.
Oh, Lisa.
Go ahead.
Sorry. I need to turn the TV off. I was getting confused by it. But anyway, when I first decided to get a divorce, I initiated it and I wanted shared parenting. It seemed like the best thing to do. But honestly, I don't think they intended anything bad, but I had friends and family who were just very much, oh, you've got to get child support. You've got to get this from him. You've got to get that from him. To add fuel to the fire, he's not from this country. He's from another country. And then there was, oh, you know, all these people watching movies. Oh, my God, he's going to kidnap your son and whisk him away to Morocco. And just a lot of sort of things that I had to channel out to make a good decision, to really look at the situation and go, this is between myself, my ex-husband, and what's best for our child, not about what mom and dad want, not about people going, you know, you've got to watch out constantly because he's just going to nab him and go, you know, and just go, we've got a little person to raise here. And also we made the decision to get married, to turn around and say, I hate this person now. I've created a child with you, but I hate you. Well, my son is turning into his dad every day. So if I say, I hate your dad, what is that?
Interesting. Dr. Farber, you talk about that.
I hate your other parents.
Mm-hmm.
And my son knows how much he's like his father. So what does that say to a child to say, you know, I got together with this man, I created him, but now I hate him?
Mm-hmm. Dr. Farber?
Lisa, it's a great comment because it's so accurate and so true. When you are angry at your ex, you're angry at your child. And we all get angry at our child as well, and sometimes deservedly so. And sometimes angry at your ex, deservedly so as well. But you can't demean your ex. You can't say to your child, your mother is no good because of all these horrible things that she's done in her life. What you can say to your child is, we once loved each other. We cared for each other a great deal. We no longer love each other in the way that we need to stay together. We both love you. We both care about you. And we would both have your best interests in mind in raising and helping you grow, helping you be raised and grow. The rally around the troops concept you raised, which is that once you get divorced, you're seen as vulnerable, or going through this process of separation, you're seen as vulnerable, and friends and family rally around you and support you. And sometimes that support is great, and sometimes that support is, let's get back at this other person. He hurt you. Well, it's good to have those kinds of friends, but sometimes it's not so great to take that advice. And sometimes it's good to know that they're there and they support you and they care about you. But as Lisa just pointed out, you're still a parent. You still have to make decisions with that other parent, and you still have to raise that very, very precious product together. So we want to do that without that animus. We want to do that. If you don't feel that you can have a comfortable working relationship, then just have a working relationship with that person. But you still have to work together. And when the anger comes out, you're not able to work together to effectively raise your child. So this rally around the troops is great for your support, but don't let it influence your co-parenting decisions, processes with your ex.
Thanks a lot, Lisa, for that call. We appreciate it. You know, interestingly, everything does go back to how the child is first introduced to the idea of the divorce and or the separation, if a couple begins that way. Can you talk about that introduction process and how it should be done? And I'm sure to some extent it varies by age.
It certainly does vary by age, Anne, but it has to be an honest process. It truly is the first step of co-parenting, is how the two parents sit down together, and I emphasize together, and share with the child that mom and dad are no longer going to be living together. And we do it with some of the same language that I just used. It's really that we no longer love each other the way we need to. What you say to the child has to be the truth. It certainly does not have to be the whole truth for two reasons. First of all, some of that stuff is beyond the child's desire to know and ability to know. And two, your perception of the truth may certainly not be your ex's perception of the truth. So what you say has to be truthful, but it shouldn't be the whole truth. And we want to make sure in that process that we don't allow the child to feel self-blame. It's my fault. I recall a young girl who sat, I'm sitting in my office right now as we speak, and a young girl who sat on my couch and was sure she knew why her parents were divorced. And the reason why was that she had hit her brother at the dining room table, the kitchen table, one night, and he had spilled his milk all over the floor. And his parents got into a big argument, father saying, you never watch the kids, mother saying, you're never home, how do you know? This child is convinced that it's because she hit her brother and he spilt the milk that her parents got a divorce. So in that early stage when you're talking to your child about mom and dad are not going to be living together, we both love you, we're both still going to be your parents, you have to always keep your ears open to that child feeling that sense of self-blame. What did I do wrong to cause this? Because, you know, the world revolves around children, right? We raise them that way, and they sort of certainly believe it's all the good stuff is because of them. Well, all the bad stuff must be because of them as well. So it's an honest, but not the whole truth, portrayal with an emphasis that this is just going to be a new stage of life.
When you talk about the reasons and telling your child the reasons, and you say you don't have to tell them the whole truth, a lot of people do tell their kids that daddy has a new girlfriend or mommy has a new, you know, or whatever it might be. Does it eventually, kids will figure it out often.
But mommy having a new boyfriend and daddy having a new girlfriend is probably not the main reason why mommy and daddy got a divorce. The reason why mommy has a new boyfriend or daddy has a new girlfriend is probably because of some real dissatisfaction with each other and a lack of love and caring for each other in that marriage. So is it really that daddy has a new girlfriend and that's why we're getting a divorce? Daddy may have a very different perception of that. Maybe it's because mom was cold and absent and drank every night before she went to sleep. So are we really going to tell the kids that and expect them to be on our sides or expect them to be the judge and determine who's really at fault? No. What we want to do is assure these children that they will have a relationship still with both of their parents, that both of their parents still care about them, and that both of their parents are going to put the children's interests first in this process, not to tell them and have them ally with us against the other parent.
There is a chapter in the book about when one parent is mentally ill and what kind of issues can come out in that. And I read the section where you write about the woman who ended up having Munchausen syndrome. That's pretty rare, but mental illness is not. What is your recommendation? How does the parent who is not ill work with the parent who is?
Well, there are two parts, I think, to that question, Anne. First is that we always have to guarantee the safety of the child. And we're not going to put any child in a situation that puts that child at risk. So if someone is an active alcoholic or drug user, for example, and has that mental illness, then we're not going to allow the child to be in a situation with that parent where that child is not safe, number one. That doesn't mean there can't be a relationship with a parent with the emotional problem or a physical problem. We still are wanting that child to have a meaningful relationship with that parent. but we have to ensure that there's a safety factor involved, that that child is not going to be hurt in any fashion. So even if a parent, for example, has schizophrenia, that doesn't mean that that child can't have a meaningful relationship with that parent. Perhaps the illness would have to be under control. Perhaps do we have to make sure that it's not active at that time, that we're not dealing with a parent who's having active hallucinatory activity. But the diagnosis by itself doesn't mean you can't have a relationship. That diagnosis was probably there for many years when that parent was raising that child and you were married and together. So by itself, it doesn't exclude it. We just have to be adapting to the reality of whatever this situation might be.
What are the differences, the advantages and disadvantages, I guess, for children who are only children or versus one or two children, or the older child versus the younger one who's left in the house after the parents' divorce? I mean, what is there any advantages to just having one? The logistics are easier, but...
That's a great question. I'm not sure I know the answer to that. And in my reading of the professional literature, I'm not sure there is a great answer to that. And certainly, clinically, kids who have a sibling and they're going through the process feel some support from the shared pain. They have a sibling who's going through the same process. Also on Friday afternoons, packing up from one house and going to the other house. Also having to juggle sometimes with what I'm bringing with me from one house to the other household. And so there's some shared pain, perhaps, in the early processes of going through this as we all adapt to the separation and divorce. On the other hand, single children sometimes feel that when they're with that parent, they're able to now develop a one-to-one relationship with that parent, and it becomes of great intensity and great meaning. So after divorce, if I'm going to be alone with my mom for a couple of days this weekend, it's really just mom and me. And it could develop into this wonderful relationship rather than this broader family structure. So I'm not sure there's a great answer that one is better or worse. Mm-hmm. You know, in each family, we have what we have, and we deal with what we deal with.
Some kids... they're still children, they don't understand what they're doing, but they play the parents off each other.
Most children.
Okay.
Early on, will try to play the parents off against each other.
It's more typical.
It is very typical. In that first year, year and a half, be aware that what your child may say to you about what goes on in the other household may very well be what that child believes he or she thinks you want to hear. So if that child believes that you're going to want to hear that I didn't eat any supper today when I was at dad's house, and sees you react and call your lawyer and call your mom and call your best friend and how dare he not feed my kid supper and this is horrible and we're going to go file lawsuits against him and I'm not going to allow him to have visitation. Well, that child sees that and has mom's attention, and it works. Now, it may be true. It may not be true. Maybe we really didn't have what we called supper because maybe we had this enormous brunch out and I really wasn't very hungry and all we had was an ice cream. And, you know, I really, dad said he was going to make me something to eat, but I told him I wasn't very hungry, or we really didn't finish eating until 2, or we went to the circus and we snacked all afternoon and really didn't have supper. So before you jump down the throats of the other person, find out what's really going on. Ask respectfully if it's of concern. And if you hear one time that there wasn't supper at the other house, before you call in the troops, maybe just back off. Make sure it's a pattern. Make sure it's not something that your child is just seeing you react to before you file the lawyer letter saying we're about to change the custodial arrangement that we spent a year structuring.
I remember a teacher who said, we'll believe half of what they say about you if you'll believe half of what they say about us.
Well, and I add a third component to that is, I only wish I knew which half to believe.
Right. That's the omniscience that we don't possess, right?
We don't have that piece. What we do have in our relationships, though, post-separation and divorce, is an opportunity to still raise very healthy children. It just requires an ability to adapt, to develop an appropriate business-like relationship with your ex, where you're respectful of each other. You're both involved in the life of the child. You do so without conflict. And please, at significant events in the life of your child, remember you're still both parents. When that fifth grader has the science fair, both parents need to be there to be able to support that child. When it's the soccer playoff game and that child's there ready to score a goal, you're both there ready to cheer on that child. It's for good and bad.
Dr. Farber, thanks for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Ann.
Once
My
again,
pleasure.
Dr. Farber will be in Columbus soon for the 50th annual Columbus Jewish Book Fair. For more, go to a link on our website at WOSU.org. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.